Japan's longest-serving prime minister is stepping down for health reasons.
People really wanted prime minister to stay in office. People really wanted political stability.
Also today, the Republican Party is returning to an old playbook. Beware of the socialists.
Biden, Harris, and the rest of the socialists will fundamentally change this nation.
And a new generation of museum curators have turned into activists, rethinking where art truly belongs.
The calls for restitution are coming from the inside, from this small group of curators.
Also, a Middle Eastern cartoonist is arrested for doing his job. Satire. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Parents out there, remember this. You're not alone. The pandemic has upended academic plans everywhere across the globe. In Mexico, they're taking a novel approach, school by TV. The federal government says more Mexicans have television sets than computers, which make televised classes more accessible. But even classes on TV can be hard to access for many students, and educators worry that the new normal may widen already large gaps between the haves and have-nots. Shannon Young has our story from Oaxaca, Mexico.
Since the start of the week, millions of school children across Mexico settle in for class in front of a screen. Not for online classes with a teacher, but for television programs.
Me da mucho gusto saludarlos en este regreso a clases.
The official plan to move forward with the school year involves agreements with the country's largest private TV networks.
Que 40 millones de personas se queden en casa permite que la pandemia sea manejable hospitalariamente.
Education Secretary Esteban Moctezuma Barragán says keeping 40 million students home allows the country to gradually reopen its economy while preventing the pandemic from overwhelming hospitals. He and other officials argue television is a more accessible medium than the internet, pointing to studies that show televisions are in 9 out of 10 Mexican homes. But statistics show TV ownership is lower in southern states like Oaxaca.
Aquí donde trabajo, pues, no hay televisión.
Adolfo Gutierrez is an elementary school teacher in a hamlet of the state's Sierra Mije region. He says broadcast classes aren't viable there because few residents own televisions, and the mountainous land can block reception of TV, radio, and cell phone signals.
Aquí en la comunidad solamente se puede trabajar yendo físicamente con los alumnos.
Gutierrez says in his community, education requires in-person contact. Not only are they shut out from the technology, but the TV classes are being taught in Spanish, not in the students' native language of Mije. His region has few cases of COVID-19 because residents closed off access to outsiders and reduced travel to cities to prevent contagion. But teachers still can't hold classes inside their schools without the consent of education and health officials.
Si no diseña un plan para la atención de estas escuelas, de estos niños.
Gutierrez says if authorities don't take into account the specific conditions and needs of indigenous students in rural areas, those children will fall behind. But he's optimistic that parents and teachers can rise to the occasion.
Es cuestión de organizarse. Y cuestión de querer hacerlo.
It's just a question of organization and will, he says. Oaxaca's teachers union is well equipped in that regard. 4 years ago, they fought federal education reforms through strikes and protests. They developed their own education plan, which federal authorities dismissed. The union is now dusting it off as an alternative to the televised model. For now, they've delayed the start of school. That leaves students like 5-year-old Sayin Mendez Madrazo in a holding pattern.
Estamos prendiendo la computadora, buscando en YouTube.
Sayin's mother, Adriana Madrazo, searches the internet for videos of TV classes. They technically have a television, but it has bad reception. So Madrazo is trying to see what's available online.
Creo que ha sido más como en rumor, en tipo rumor.
Madrazo says it's been hard to find online videos through official channels. She went to the Education Secretariat's Facebook page and ended up in the comments section with hundreds of other confused parents. The Education Secretariat is now posting videos to a YouTube channel.
tengo curiosidad de qué proponen, ¿no? Entonces,
Madrazo says she's curious to see how the TV classes pan out, but she's unlikely to rely on them. Her biggest concern is that Zain, an only child, has not had regular contact with other kids his age since mid-March. She's looking to form a small group with like-minded parents. In the meantime, she and her partner will continue to make their at-home routines as educational as possible. During their months of confinement, the family started a garden and began raising turkeys, chickens, and ducks. Madrazo says caring for other living beings is what most captures her son's attention. It's been a good learning experience for all.
Una parte muy bonita de la pandemia.
And, she jokes, a nice side of the pandemic. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Japan's leader is stepping down. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said today that he is resigning because of health problems, pushing Japan into a period of political uncertainty. Abe has been Japan's prime minister for nearly 8 straight years, a record for the country. He's kept U.S.-Japanese relations on a steady course through 2 American presidencies. Hiroki Takeuchi teaches political science at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. Hiroki Takeuchi, how big a surprise is Prime Minister Abe's resignation?
Well, it is surprising, at the same time, not surprising. I knew that he went to see a doctor, and then also he has disease. There was some expectation that he might step down if this disease came back.
And that's ulcerative colitis that he suffers from.
Right.
Shinzo Abe has been Japan's leader during 2 very different U.S. presidencies. How has he threaded those 2 very different needles?
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. So Abe has been doing very well with both Obama and Trump. So other countries' leader, like Ms. Merkel, had a good relationship with Obama, but not with Trump. Mr. Netanyahu had a good relationship with Trump, but didn't have a good relationship with Obama. So he did a very good job that other leaders couldn't do.
What are the big issues between Japan and the U.S. that any Japanese prime minister has to tend to?
I think it really depends on who will be elected as U.S. president in November. If Biden is elected, then kind of rebuilding the alliance relationship between the United States and Japan is the biggest issue and our biggest task. It seems like Mr. Biden is more eager to appreciate the importance of U.S.-Japan alliance. If Trump is reelected, then the biggest issue is what Japan should do to lead the so-called liberal international order, where U.S. was the leader of the liberal international order for a long time, but Trump has not been interested in leading it. So Japan has to play a certain role to lead the international order, liberal international order. That's actually the big issue.
Are the Japanese people broadly supportive of Shinzo Abe's style and approach to issues so that his successor will likely carry that on? Or do they want to change in terms of approach and priorities?
I think it's both. And then also it depends on who you ask. So Abe actually consolidated the authority or centralized the authority to the prime minister's office. So that actually makes his policy making and policy implementation effective. But at the same time, many people criticize him, like Abe's style is more authoritarian. So people have a mixed feeling on Abe. But having said that, actually, there is no choice now that a new leader has to come in. And then even if people who are close to Abe, like Mr. Suga or Mr. Kishida, even if they come in to office, they are very different from Abe. So I think we will see institutionally how a new leader will manage the prime ministership. That's actually a very big question.
Are there real generational differences in terms of how the Japanese view Shinzo Abe and therefore what they want in the future?
Yes. Generation gap or generation variation is the biggest variation that Japanese politics has right now. In general, younger people tend to be more supportive for Mr. Abe, and then older people tend to be more critical.
Hmm.
One reason is younger people tend to be more internationalist, and Abe is more popular abroad than in domestic. So so Abe's foreign policy is actually more popular than domestic policy. So and then the younger people appreciate Abe's economic policy, because until COVID-19, actually, unemployment rate was low in Japan. So the younger people appreciated the economic conditions. But now it's actually, of course, it's different after COVID. So,
and Shinzo Abe has ulcerative colitis, and it's gotten worse, and that's why he is stepping down. I mean, is he okay, or is there something more serious than simply, I'm too sick to be prime minister?
This is actually the same disease that he had, and the cause of his resignation of his first term in 2007. So it's actually very concerning. At that time, the symptom was so severe that he had to resign. And then this time, again, he had to resign for the same disease. So I think it's very concerning, but you know, only like medical experts who are seeing Abe know.
Hiroki, what is Shinzo Abe's legacy?
I think his legacy is twofold. One is security legislation that was legislated in 2015 that really consolidated the U.S.-Japan security alliance. The second is leading Trans-Pacific Partnership, now called the CPTPP. So when U.S. withdrew from the TPP, then under Trump, people thought and the world thought that the TPP would be over. But Japan came back, and then working with other allies like Canada, Mexico, Australia. So now a very big free trade agreement, mega free trade agreement to manage trade based on the global value chains in the Asia Pacific. And I would add one more thing, that is his biggest legacy probably would be his being prime minister for almost 8 years. So before Abe in 2012, Japan had six prime ministers in 6 years, including himself. And so a Japanese prime minister was called a calendar, every year a different person. people thought, people really wanted prime minister to stay in office. People really wanted political stability. And Abe achieved it. Basically, so Abe achieved what his predecessors, many of his predecessors, had failed to achieve.
Hiroki Takeuchi teaches at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. I want to thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
A summer of protest against racial injustice has Americans and people around the globe grappling with deep problems of racism. That outrage was reignited this week with the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Coming up on The World, a look at how a lack of racial and ethnic representation undermines community safety and even U.S. national security.
When you have kind of a homogenous group of people that are attempting to find smart solutions to issues, you're not going to find necessarily some of the most thoughtful and innovative things when you don't have that diversity of experience within a room.
More from Bishop Garrison, U.S. Army veteran and national security expert, is coming up just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. As our nation again confronts the impact of racism, it's not just individuals, families, and communities that suffer. Racism also undermines the safety of our country, our national security. That's the view of our next guest, Bishop Garrison. He served two tours in Iraq with the U.S. Army and held several national security roles in President Obama's administration. He's now the Director of National Security Outreach at Human Rights First. Bishop, in your years first in the Army and then in national security roles, what experiences did you have that convinced you that systemic racism can undermine national security?
Well, the biggest things I've witnessed thus far is just the predominance of white supremacy, the continued rise of it, particularly here in recent years, as we've had opportunities to engage it directly. But we're also seeing internationally kind of across the world in authoritarian regimes, the resurgence of these types of hate speech and of violent action and rhetoric directed at vulnerable communities, particularly minority communities, communities of color. So and this is something that just didn't happen within the last few months or few years. This has taken some time over the last decade plus to persist. And as much, we've just seen a lack of proper engagement on it. So this is something that's going to take the totality of the national security apparatus to engage. And I'm hoping we're going to have an opportunity to do so soon.
Can you name some experiences or instances that you experienced directly that you feel were missed opportunities or were simply ignored and not engaged upon?
No. So for me, from my own personal experiences, the biggest things have been more about just inherent bias and underlying prejudice. I've never had anyone directly engage me and call me an outright racist name, or I've never had anyone attack me based on any type of immutable traits. What I will say is I've walked into more than one room and been the only African-American to speak on a variety of topics or issues in professional settings. And when you have those types of consistent experiences and you have those types of environments, you're going to have a lack of representation, a lack of proper voices within the room to help create the best possible innovative decisions. You're going to have a lot of policies that are on their face going to have some type of bias that needs to be overcome.
What kind of specific issues did you feel like you were the only person in the room, in national security roles?
I mean, like anything you can imagine, from just speaking on defense innovation to talking about issues of Iraq, Afghanistan, how we handle green technology, for instance. I live and work in D.C., and this is not a hit against any particular group of people or any individuals. It's just something that persist within this type of environment. And when you have kind of a homogenous group of people that are attempting to find smart solutions to issues, you're not going to find the most thoughtful and innovative things when you don't have that diversity of experience within a room.
So it's an issue of representation in these departments, in these positions, in these areas of national security. There's just still very little representation of non-whites.
Correct. And I mean, and this isn't just the policy side of the house, too. Even when you look at the military, you're looking at an 85%+ of officers are white, when the percentage of African-Americans and people of color in your enlisted far outweigh that. So we're not even seeing proper representation in the world's greatest meritocracy in the United States military. So and then that's problematic.
How does racism fit into the larger context of threats to national security?
So the biggest thing we're seeing right now is violent white extremism, white supremacy, individuals who believe that their race and they see themselves as the white race is naturally above all other races and people within the world. We're starting to see them act out in violent ways. We've had more mass shootings by people with affiliations to that particular demographic than we have in issues of international terrorism. So having these types of thoughts, having them perpetuated, and even still having higher level individuals who are pushing these types of thoughts through policy and through rhetoric are only enabling these folks that are going to go out and act in aggressive, violent manners to do so.
After the killing of George Floyd by police 3 months ago, you called on the national security community to fight racial injustice. Who were you speaking to, and what did you want them to do?
Yeah, I was speaking directly to my colleagues. I wrote that piece with John Wolfsall, who's a proliferation expert here in Washington, D.C. And the biggest thing that we were attempting to do was begin a conversation within our community, within the national security community. We see that even that community lacks a proper representation, particularly at the higher levels, but really across the board. And if we don't allow for young, diverse, talented individuals to come in at lower ranks, they aren't going to hit the proper prerequisites. assets to negate the merit to be placed into those higher positions or have the experience necessary to do well in those prior positions. So we really wanted to kind of point the attention back in on ourselves and have this kind of a come to Jesus, if you will, about what it means to have proper representation within a community and national security and why it's important. We're not talking about diversity for diversity's sake. We're not talking about taking people away from the table or giving anyone any less opportunity. We're talking about building a bigger table. We're talking about figuring out ways to properly recruit talent so that we have a diversity of thought and a diversity of experience. A more diverse workplace tends to be a happier workplace, and it tends to provide better solutions and better outcomes for the problems you face.
What can the military do to improve racial representation?
I think first we need to look at our officer corps. We need to look more at how cadets are recruited at the military academies. It's not simply about where we go, but it's about the messaging as well. And I think it's going to take some level of not simply a rebranding or polishing up of how the military presents itself and how America even presents itself in the global community. I think a lot of this is going to be what types of policies are in place from a strategic perspectives and what our relationships with our allies looks like in order to really bring more interest in from this new generation of younger people about what service really means. The American people want to see themselves in those that help defend their country and then those that help to lead that force. And the American people are a very diverse group of people. They are not all young, strong, smart white men from middle America. So it behooves us to do what we can to ensure that they are properly represented within our forces as well.
Bishop Garrison is an Iraq War veteran, and he held several national security roles in President Obama's administration. He's now the Director of National Security Outreach at Human Rights First. Thanks a lot, Bishop.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You join us here every day because of the stories that make you think deeply about the world. As you head into the weekend, take a moment to share those stories that really stick with you. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is easy to remember. We are at The World. There you can find the stories you hear on the show and connect with the journalists who report them. You're listening to The World. The pandemic is killing comedy clubs. In Scotland, comics have said, we need help too.
And if me standing on a stage invoking a reaction, if that's not considered an art form, I don't know what is.
A big win for the folks who keep Scots laughing. Ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH in Boston and PRX. Last night, President Trump made things official and accepted the Republican nomination for president.
And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it.
Throughout the four-day convention, Republicans repeatedly tried to paint the U.S. as being at a dire crossroads. One word was said over and over, socialist. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum.
If you just randomly tuned in to the Republican National Convention this week, you'd be forgiven for thinking you'd landed in the 1950s.
Biden, Harris, and the rest of the socialists will fundamentally change this nation.
Speaker after speaker warned that the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, was an agent of the radical socialist left. And if he wins, they said, our country will slide into a communist dictatorship.
The same socialist policies which destroyed places like Cuba and Venezuela must not take root in our cities.
Joe Biden and the radical left are now coming for our freedom of speech.
Their vision for America is socialism, and we know that socialism has failed everywhere.
At one point during the convention, Florida businessman Maximo Alvarez took the stage. Alvarez was 13 years old when he fled Cuba, just as Fidel Castro and the communists took over the island. Alvarez said that Biden is mostly concerned with power, and then he delivered this warning.
I have seen people like this before. We cannot let them take over our country.
Alvarez's message is a continuation of an ad campaign the Republican National Committee started last year when it looked like Warren or Sanders would get the nomination. The campaign is called Victims of Socialism. It features video montages like this one.
Free tuition at public colleges.
It shows Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Free tuition and fees.
And then it cuts to a Venezuelan exile named Warner, who says he was put in prison by the Maduro regime.
The socialist person, they are very good as a poet, and they are very good in oratory.
Warren and Sanders didn't win the nomination, but that didn't seem to have an effect on the RNC's messaging. When Biden got the nomination, they just said he's under the control of Warren Sanders and the Squad, an ethnically diverse group of four junior congresswomen. And the messaging goes, Biden's election will lead to a socialist dictatorship.
The Republican Party has done this many times in the past.
That's Sherry Berman. She's a political science professor at Barnard College.
You heard similar kind of rhetoric with FDR's New Deal. You heard it also with Great Society programs. The idea that any kind of increased government intervention in the economy was going to lead us on a slippery slope to communist dictatorships.
For example, Ronald Reagan in 1961 warned that Medicare would lead to socialism.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine.
For the brave.
Republican Barry Goldwater said LBJ was embracing a socialist party platform.
Not to cringe before the bullying of communism.
My opponent is far outside the mainstream of economic thinking.
There was George H.W. Bush in 1992.
Moving away from the socialistic high-control experience.
I think his plans of are redistribution of the wealth.
And John McCain in 2008.
That's one of the tenets of socialism.
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many.
But the most dramatic example is Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s, claiming that hundreds of communists had infiltrated the U.S. government.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
These days, the Republicans are trying to substitute Venezuela for the Soviet Union. But Jack Pitney, a strategist for the RNC in the 1980s, says the strategy isn't going to work very well with young people who have no memory of the Cold War. These days, Pitney teaches politics at Claremont McKenna College.
When I confront a room full of young people, I'm looking at people who weren't even born when the Soviet Union was still in existence. So trying to talk about a relationship of this to socialism and communism simply isn't going to work on anybody under the age of 40.
Also, Americans' perception of socialism has changed in the past 70 years. High levels of income inequality have led to a growing sense among young people that capitalism doesn't work. Now, it's true, most of those people are Democrats. But the Pew Charitable Trust conducted a survey in 2019 that found that even among Republicans, young Republicans are twice as likely to have a positive view of socialism than older Republicans. Carol Doherty is the director of political research for Pew. He says on top of that, young Republicans favor policies like free college tuition.
This is a proposal that's a real expansion of the government's role in providing support for education, and young people are broadly behind it. 55% of all young Republicans favor it.
So likening it to a slide into dictatorship probably won't fly with that demographic. But Jack Pitney, the strategist-turned professor, says Red Scare messaging could work with voters in the all-important swing state of Florida.
Florida has a very large Cuban-American population, very anti-Castro, also has substantial numbers of people from Venezuela, Nicaragua, and the people who come here tend to be very hostile to communism.
Pitney says they're the target audience for the RNC ads and anti-socialist language.
If they can move the Hispanic American vote in Florida by just a couple of points, that could be crucial.
It's also more than that. When Trump and his surrogates talk about socialism, they aren't necessarily talking about policy or even drawing parallels to specific countries. After all, most voters aren't thinking about those things, says political science professor Sherry Berman. No, socialism here is a lot like code, a way of saying the other side is posing an existential threat to the American way of life.
This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny.
It's part of a fear campaign to portray your opponents as dangerous and evil and not just different from you.
Berman says the Republican base is already primed to hear this message and will likely respond to it.
By bringing up the sort of Venezuela and Cuba examples, you're not only painting the Democrats as extremists, but you're raising fear and resentment in your own base, which is likely to mobilize them, get them to the polls, yada, yada, yada.
Berman says, yes, tarring the other side as socialist or communist or radical is part of a longstanding tradition in American politics. But because we're so polarized right now, she says, it has the potential to be something quite dangerous. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
A Jordanian political cartoonist has been arrested. His alleged crime, satirizing the Israel-United Arab Emirates' recent diplomatic agreement to normalize relations. Imad Hajjaj is a beloved cartoonist in Jordan and around the Middle East. On Wednesday, he posted a cartoon on Facebook showing a dove emblazoned with an Israeli flag spitting in the face of Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed. An Arabic inscription reading Spit 35 is written on the saliva. That's meant to mock the back and forth over whether the UAE will receive American-built F-35 fighter jets as part of the deal. Hajjaj has been charged with disturbing relations with a sister country. Terry Anderson is executive director of the human rights group Cartoonist Rights Network International. Terry, you're a political cartoonist and you defend and fight on behalf of political cartoonists around the globe. What do we know about the circumstances of Imad Hajjaj's arrest on Wednesday?
So in recent days and weeks, he's done a number of cartoons that portray the Crown Prince of UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, or MBZ for short, anthropomorphizing him. At one point, he's a megaphone being held by Benjamin Netanyahu. In one of the more vociferous cartoons, he's a knife plunged into the back of a Palestinian figure. And then on Wednesday itself, the last in this run of cartoons was posted, and it portrays MBZ holding in his hands a dove piece, which is identified on its flank with the flag of Israel, and it's kind of spitting in his face. And this is in reference to the fighter jet deal between the United States and UAE, which in recent days became a sticking point for Israel in these talks. And so, in a weird way, this last cartoon, even though it's presumed that this is the cartoon that's caused the most offence, it's strangely sympathetic to MBZ because he's kind of the injured party.
Now, as I understand it, Imad Hajjaj posted that cartoon you just described to his Facebook page on Wednesday, and hours later, officials showed up to arrest him?
Yes, on his website, his social media channels, it also ran in the New Arab news outlet based in the UK. And within a few hours, he was arrested at the behest of the public prosecutor. The case has essentially been deferred to a higher court, what's called the State Security Court, this coming Sunday.
What has Imad Hajjaj been charged with?
So the arrest has been made under cybercrime law, but specifically under that law, it's insulting another Arab nation. So at the heart of this whole case seems to be sensitivity to diplomatic relations.
And you mentioned the F-35 fighter jets as a sort of sub-theme. Is the idea that the UAE was going to get F-35 fighter jets from the U.S. in exchange for normalizing relations with Israel, and now Benjamin Netanyahu is kind of interfering to make that impossible?
Yeah, it seems that that was one of the kind of conditions or sweeteners, if you like, on the deal from UAE's perspective. And of course, Netanyahu himself is beleaguered at the moment. It seems that at home he came under some domestic pressure to instruct his diplomats to voice an objection. They had previously voiced consent, but in very recent days they've gotten cold feet about it.
You follow all these countries because you represent cartoonists like Imad who get in trouble with governments. Is this unusual to be happening in Jordan? Is Jordan generally more tolerant?
Generally speaking, yes, I would say it is unusual compared with other nations in the region. Certainly, Jordan has a better track record on this kind of thing. Freedom of speech is in their constitution, although they do caveat it with freedom of expression, provided it does not contravene the law. And of course, laws are subject to change and amendment.
How would you describe Imad Hajjaj's cartoons, his style, his approach as a cartoonist?
Imad is probably Jordan's most well-known cartoonist, certainly outside of Jordan. And of course, he's very much concerned with politics in the region, but often turns his eye to, you know, broader issues. He cartoons about politics in the USA. One of the more recent ones that he posted before arrest was about the ongoing police violence in the United States against African Americans, for example.
How worried are you about Imad Hajjaj's case?
Quite worried. It's always of concern when someone who simply reserves the right to make observations about politics, about life in general, is criminalized for it. He certainly and categorically has not done anyone any harm. It's impossible to see how any of the cartoons he's produced recently could be regarded in that way. And more than that, even if there were offence taken in either of the royal families of either countries concerned, it's hard to see how cartoons like this could derail political processes and diplomatic processes between two sovereign states.
Terry Anderson is Executive Director of the human rights group Cartoonist Rights Network International. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
Now, perhaps more than ever, we need a good laugh. Thank goodness for the comedians out there, but comedians also need help getting through this pandemic, and many say they haven't been getting the support they need. Until now, The World's Bianca Hillier reports on attempts in Scotland to take comedy seriously.
As comedian Susie McCabe stood on stage at Scotland's famous comedy club, The Stand, she had a request for the virtual audience.
So I need to get a wee bit serious at this point. Those of you that
McCabe ditched her award-winning raconteur style and bluntly explained that comedy in Scotland is at risk.
We are getting no funding to support us. Clubs might not be able to survive.
Survival post-pandemic, she said, will require help from the government. And the country's comedy industry hasn't directly received any of that, she said, because the Scottish government doesn't consider comedy to be an art form.
If me standing on a stage invoking a reaction, if that's not considered an art form, I don't know what is.
What is considered art and is eligible for funding is what you'll find in museums, concert halls, and theaters. Those nonprofit institutions have received a big bailout package from the government, and comedians across Scotland have spent the past few months campaigning for a chunk of that change. Today, some good news from the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon.
I can confirm today a further £59 million package of support for the culture and heritage sectors.
More than $78 million is headed to the arts, explicitly noted in the announcement.
Galleries, comedy venues. Orchestras.
Comedy venues are getting some cash. Individual comedians could be too. Another $7 million is being allocated to creative freelancers.
We're in jubilant mode at the moment.
Jojo Sutherland is a Scottish comedian and founding member of the Association of the Scottish Comedic Arts, or ASCA, which has spearheaded the movement. She and other ASCA members have been in continuous contact with the government, sharing why they need money now. Their efforts have paid off.
Having an association like ASCA really helps.
That's Laura Mackenzie Stewart. She's the head of theatre at Creative Scotland, which distributes the Scottish government's arts funding. And she's one of the people who's been listening to what ASCA has to say.
What that does is helps pool the information together in a way that kind of qualifies and quantifies the need.
In other words, there's strength in numbers. For the record, Mackenzie Stewart says she does consider comedy to be an art form, but...
But just by being an art form doesn't necessarily create an absolute direct match for public funding.
Comedian Jojo Sutherland says commercial comedy clubs are typically profitable on their own. But over the past few months, some of the wealthiest comedians have dug into their own pockets to help the industry. To Sutherland, the problem goes beyond the bottom line.
It shouldn't be the responsibility of a few successful comedians to change the attitude towards the art form. That's the real crux of the matter here.
This matter is not a uniquely Scottish fight. Comedians in England and Canada, for example, are also trying to get specific funds from their governments. As for the Scots, they aren't done yet. Sutherland says ASCA will continue to lobby for more funding to make sure Scottish comedians are back on stage making people laugh as soon as possible.
We're still not over the finishing line. We still have to get live comedy recognised as an art form in Scotland. So there's still work to be done.
In terms of the immediate need for help, though, today's announcement is significant. So this weekend, a celebration. Sutherland says she and other proud Scottish comedians are meeting up on Sunday to give each other a socially distanced pat on the back. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Who does art belong to? That's a centuries-old debate, and also a recent topic on the Intelligence podcast. It comes to us from Economist Radio in London. Jason Palmer is the host. Interesting topic, Jason. Who did you speak to?
It's a fascinating topic. I spoke to Fionnuala Rocco, who is the Economist's culture correspondent, and she told me a story about an activist and some of his friends who visited the Musée du Quai Branly in Paris in June. And he simply took a statue, originally from South Sudan, and said he was there to restitute stolen goods from Africa. They were arrested and are now awaiting trial. This isn't, as you say, a new debate. And Fiametta said that the pressure really started in the 1970s when museums started to be petitioned to return objects from where they were stolen or seized.
Now, overall, most museums have been hesitant. There's been legal challenges brought against this effort. But the pressure is getting louder, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's coming from different directions. I mean, museums are institutions that move slowly. They're conservative. They're careful. They're in the business of conservation. And in the past, it was the countries where artifacts were stolen from that have led the charge. African countries, places like Greece. Famously, there's this debate about the Elgin marbles in the British Museum here in London. But as Fiametta said, the calls for change are really starting to come from elsewhere. And here's a bit of that conversation.
What we're seeing now is a new generation of curators who are advocates, activists, and the calls for restitution are coming from the inside, from this small group of curators who are coming towards the top of their institutions.
What is it that's driving that change then? Why are curators having this evident change of heart?
So the real game changer was a report that President Emmanuel Macron of France commissioned at the end of 2017. For the first time, you had academics and curators calling for real change. They described it as a change in relational ethics, by which they meant there should be a much, much more egalitarian discussion between the countries that objects came from and the countries where these objects have ended up.
And so where do these activist curators fit into the story?
So this is a generation of curators who really started working in the early 2000s when the trend of world museums was at its height. These were the places where you could compare cultures from all over the world, where you could see objects that had universal connections. But within the argument in favor of world museums was a selfish attitude. What one museum director described to me as what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine. This new generation of curators who are now in their late 40s and early 50s and are coming to the top of their institutions have also been driven by what they've seen over the last 5 years. The Rhodes Must Fall movement in South Africa and in Oxford, and of course, Black Lives Matter.
That's Fiametta Rocco, culture correspondent for The Economist. She was speaking to Jason Palmer of the Intelligence podcast. Jason, did Fiametta mention who or where some of these leading activist museum curators are?
Well, the most prominent is probably Dan Hicks at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, which has 500,000 objects, and he's been looking in great detail into where they actually came from. Just one example, there's a big collection from Benin in West Africa, and he dug into this brutal history of how a British garrison just razed the palace of Benin's ruler and gathered up all the treasures, basically. I mean, there's so many of these stories, not just the history of the objects, but also the histories of their travels. And the whole debate is an extremely nuanced one. So much disputed ownership, revisionist histories, and it's not often clear what's best for the objects, for the museums, for the countries of origin. I guess to get a better sense of it, I would point you to the podcast.
It's really interesting, Jason. So much more to hear on the Intelligence podcast. Jason Palmer is the show's host. The Intelligence is a podcast of Economist Radio in London. Jason, thanks, and we look forward to having you back again.
It'll be a pleasure.
When me say a party be there, tell them to put on the gun, the gun, the gun.
It's one of the biggest street parties in Europe, the annual Notting Hill Carnival. For 3 days at the end of summer, more than 1 million people descend on London's Notting Hill neighborhood. It's a celebration rooted in Caribbean culture.
The girl them fi come ya, come in the night, me say don't bring the gun ya, bring fi a queen, look the machine, beat the magazine, me say what a crime scene.
The streets fill with sounds of reggae, hip-hop, and soca. That's music that originated in Trinidad and Tobago in the early 70s. The music you're hearing now is the genre dub, basically reggae with some echo, reverb, and other sound effects thrown into the mix.
I am them so like a cheese and bun, ya me tell them about Babylon, I come, ya. You know this something long like you come, but what?
The Notting Hill Carnival was created by black Londoners in the 60s. They wanted to express themselves in the face of racism. In 1959, a series of racially motivated attacks on Caribbean Londoners moved Trinidadian activist Claudia Jones to launch what was at the time an indoor festival. It grew into floats and performances with elaborate costumes and masquerade masks, all rooted in the traditions of the Caribbean.
We don't want our children to lose their identity. We don't want them to lose the culture.
That's a costume maker last year talking about the importance of the event. She's speaking with The Guardian. Of course, in 2020, it's a whole new ballgame. The pandemic has made the festival impossible. But many who go each year say they need the event now more than ever in the face of inflamed racial tension. So the show will go on, virtually. But here's the silver lining. The event can reach people across the globe this year. It's being live streamed for free.
Sweet music, cartel, represent for the girl them. We represent for the girl them.
New York girl them. London girl them.
Represent for the girl them.
Dozens of musical performances and a virtual parade with 30 street performance groups. What does a virtual parade look like? Check it out tomorrow at letsgodo.com.
Just wake up in the morning. You look good, not pop down and tired. Them are use over, you are use prior. Anything you wear, dear man, I admire. I give your man bone, shot will fire.
Some reggae dance hall to play us into the weekend by singer and composer Vybz Kartel, a.k.a. World Boss. A fitting way to close the world today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you on Monday.
I wanna pop champagne with you. You're so beautiful. I wanna pop champagne with you. Be my. I wanna baby. Pop champagne with you. Be my. You're so beautiful. I wanna pop champagne with you. My. You know I come beg like blind man. German, give your thousands of dollars. House full of furniture like goats.
From PRX.